I often say that addiction is the result of not knowing how to find safety inside of yourself. So you find it in something else, and understandably, you get hooked on it because you're desperate for safety. That's all you're guilty of. Any of you looking to learn more about supporting addiction recovery through a trauma-informed and somatic lens and a nutritional lens, please join me for my addiction circle. This is a bi-monthly, entirely free virtual circle that I invite anyone here to come and join if they want more information. Addiction tends to be so steeped in shame, and I find that doing this work in a community of people helps to destigmatize that shame so you can see how not alone you are in the experience. So whether you are personally withdrawing, preventing, experiencing relapse, or you work with people who are actively addicted or in recovery, all are welcome.
The next Addiction Circle will be held on Tuesday, May 7th at 5 p.m. EDT. This meeting is not recorded for the sake of anonymity. No registration is necessary. Just join through the link below.
In the spaces that are being lauded as safe in my own community groups, in all of the different groups that I was now a part of, in regards to race or disabilities or whatever it might be, there's this idea that no one is free until we are all free. Mm-hmm. So you shouldn't just be focusing on recovery. You should be focusing on recovery for people who are Black, but recovery for people who are Black and disabled, mm-hmm. recovery for people who are Black, disabled, and trans. Mm-hmm. And you need to be including everyone. And I did my fucking best, Lewis, but as you can imagine, there's only...
I'm seeing this like sweet, tired, well-meaning young woman trying her best. Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast, where we explore life through the lens of somatics. I'm Luis Mujica, a somatic educator who teaches people how to find safety in themselves. Your turn to learn begins now. Africa Brooke, welcome to my show. I am so excited to be here with you.
Thank you. Me too. I feel so honored. I have a deep reverence and respect for you and your work. So thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
I was saying before I hit record, I don't know why I speak before I hit record, because then I just say it anyway after I hit record.
Me too.
Okay. But, you know, I was saying to Africa that I was 3 years ago or so, I was having all these really fertile conversations, very private, I should say, conversations with friends around the identity of oppression, which is different from the experience of oppression. And we were playing with this and trying to get our words down to make sense of what we were feeling. And then I had come by this gorgeous post of you on Instagram, this portrait of your face. And I'm pretty sure it was the first line. I remember it as the first line saying, "I am not oppressed." And as I read it, you went into talking about how proclaiming you weren't oppressed offended so many people. And I loved that, because that's what I was trying to get at in this. Why is it so soothing for a group to attach an identity of oppression onto people in the name of liberation? It was this fantastic confusion I was just fascinated with, still am, but more fascinated at the time. So thank you. Just, it's one testament to your work. It's why I'm so drawn to you, is you clearly, calmly and kindly speak to the most controversial, sensitive issues. It's a real gift. So I thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And I know the exact post that you're talking about, and it's still there right now. I'm wearing my white shirt and I'm sitting on my sofa, the same sofa that I'm looking at now. And I wrote those words right after I took those photos. And I remember feeling a sense of, I remember feeling scared, but also very excited, and almost like a type of arousal of all of my senses, if you will. Because I was inching closer and closer and closer to my personal freedom in a way that I never imagined I would. I hadn't even realized that I had been in somewhat of what I think of as a golden cage. I hadn't realized that I'd been in this golden cage of identity where I was being told what I needed to feel because of the way that I've been racialized in the world, where I was being told what my thoughts should be, what my politics should be, that I should even have politics, right? So I'm sure we're going to get into the intricacies of this, and I would love to hear your experience of this timeline too, because 2020, 21, 22, it was a very unique and special timeline for a lot of people. So those words, every time that I read them, because I like to go through my own archive and documentation quite a lot, so I can really remind myself that this courage and bravery that I feel today didn't always exist in the way that it does, you know, and that it's going to go through so many different iterations. So I love the process of documentation because you get to see those iterations that you've been through. But that was a big declaration for me. And it's one of my favorite pieces of writing that I've shared publicly, actually. So thank you.
I'm just marinating in that, especially that piece about being scared, fear being a full body arousal, which really is power, isn't it? That we talk about when we're scared and stressed. It's power wanting to be unfurled through us and be seen. So I love that the power was in you. There was fear, yet you allowed it to move and be seen. And just like your incredible essay and everything else you do in this amazing book that people are about to get, it serves so deeply this power that comes through you that was once repressed because of fear.
Yes, absolutely. And the reason why, my own very personal reason for being so excited with sitting you today, is because of your work, of the somatic experience, of all of these other things that tend to be approached from a very intellectual mind lens. Because I think we really underestimate just the physical, visceral experience of something before you even say it, during and after. And for me, that's why I was drawn to your work quite a lot, and why a lot of people in my audience refer me to your work, because I think they really marry well together, right? Because I realize the more that I dive deeper into the work that I do, really wanting to understand the intricacies of self-sabotage, self-censorship, I am constantly reminded now more than ever that the mind and the spoken word and the intellectual experience of bravery and courage is just a small part of it, right? I can't wait to speak to you about that side of things and how you view brave expression from that somatic space.
Me too. I'm so excited about that, because at the very top of your book, you talk about the biology of belonging.
Yes.
And that is so much about my studies and my fascination and what I do with people. So we're going to like nerd out on that in a little bit.
Yes.
What I wanted to do for anyone who doesn't know you, which I think it might be half and half. I have most people in my audience are going to freak when they see your name pop up on the podcast list. And the other people are going to say, oh, who's that? Interesting name, interesting person. I want to hear about her. So why don't we start with just a little kind of intro? Let's start with what you do in the world now and then how you got there.
Amazing. So what I do in the world, and I love this because it's one of those things where you have to try and condense so many things and try to, you know, and I'm sure as a fellow idea generator, I'm sure you experience this too. But what I do in the world in terms of my day-to-day work, I am a developmental coach, and I'll get specific as to what type of developmental coaching that I do. And I have a consulting firm, and I mainly work with people that are hyper-visible in some way. Tends to be people that are what we refer to as famous for the most part. And I have been drawn to this work because a lot of people have been thrust into visibility against their will. And when that happens, these people experience their shadow in a way that most people will never ever understand. And that is where my fascination lies. I am so obsessed in the healthiest way possible with the things that we deny, with the parts of ourselves that we repressed. I think there's so much beauty in darkness. We all have it, whether we like it or not. But when you learn to befriend your own darkness and you learn how to work with it and how to harness it and alchemize it, you can truly live a life in integrity. So I have made it my mission to really understand the workings of what we call self-sabotage and self-censorship. So I work with individuals, but I also work with teams. I work with individual clients that are not in the public eye. But the two main pillars that hold up the work that I do are self-sabotage and self-censorship. And the vehicles that I do that work through is developmental coaching. So very strategic approach to getting someone from A to Z. But then I also do consulting, a very long term, much slower process where I work with people for a minimum of 12 months. Because for me, there's never any rush. I don't work in a rush. I don't believe in urgency. But I'm also a researcher. And the work that I do, we'll dive into it, I'm sure, as we go on, came from my own needing to face my own darkness in very severe ways. I was an addict for a long time, from the age of 14 up until 24, so a full decade. In some of my most formative years, I was in the clutches of addiction. And I always say that I'm so grateful that I've always loved to read. I've always been very curious because books led me to psychology. And the thing that helped me stay sober was throwing myself into that world, but also specifically shadow work. So that's kind of as neatly as I can put what I do in the world today.
And I love that what you do in the world blossoms from your own experiences of trauma and pain, similar to me. And I wonder, when you say addiction, 10 years, alcohol, that was your addiction, correct?
Yes, yes.
So a decade of addiction, 14, such a young age to start drinking. You've been open about this before, that a lot of this was kind of your desperation to remedy a lot of internal trauma from a violent upbringing. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Can you speak onto that at all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So despite my accent, I was born and raised in Zimbabwe. I am 31 years old now, but I came to the UK when I was 9 years old. And I didn't even... Where I'm from in Zimbabwe, especially at that time, abuse is not really a word that is ever uttered at all, you know, let alone words like trauma or mental health or even anything in the realm of emotions or addressing the intricacies of someone's inner world. It's just not culturally spoken about. So if there is physical abuse in the home, there's emotional abuse in the home, you either pray it away, or you go and speak to someone at church, or if you're a woman, you're asked, what did you do to make your husband do that? And my mom got all three of those things. So I grew up in a home where domestic violence was pretty much the norm, but, you know, me and my siblings and my mom were not the only people in our village or in our town getting hit. It's just what happens in the home. But my father was also an alcoholic. He was a very, very serious alcoholic. He was a wonderful man. And I will never not say that. Something that I always say too is that I'm so grateful for my father and my family and the home that I grew up in, because it's where I learned how to hold multiple truths. I didn't just see my father as purely evil. Not at all. When he was sober, he was wonderful. He was the sharpest dressed person. He was so charming. He was pretty quiet. He was very observant. He could walk into a room and really capture a room without having to do much. I saw just how magnificent this man was. He was also hilarious. He was a teacher, so he was good with kids, which me and my siblings laugh about. He was good with other people's children. Yeah. But Maxwell was a brilliant, brilliant man. He was wonderful, you know. And I love collecting stories from his siblings, from the people that grew up with him before alcohol, you know, became a big part of his life, because it helps me humanize him. But it's truly where I learned to hold multiple truths and to love the complexities of my father, even though I was terrified of him. And
I want to pause for a minute. You said something please. Important. Helps me humanize him.
Yes.
I just wanted to just drop that, because that's a huge part of this giant work that you do.
Yeah.
And the work I love to do in the world is essentially humanize. And so your father, through these experiences of him having many different truths, One being abusive at times, one being gorgeous at times, one being gentle at times. All that together gave you this practice of, oh, many things can exist at once. And that helps you humanize him.
Absolutely. And thank you. Thank you for pulling that thread and just letting us sort of just look at it for a moment, right?
So important.
Right. But I ended up later on in life, not even that much later, replicating my father's patterns. My siblings went in the completely different direction. You know, and I think it's that thing that tends to happen with children of alcoholics. Either you end up being turned off the vice completely, or you end up replicating the pattern. So my siblings, I have one younger brother, two older sisters, and my mother, all of them, they turned away from alcohol completely, but I turned towards it with full force when we had moved to the UK. And also the thing is, culturally, where I am in the UK, London especially, the drinking culture is so severe. It's just seen as something that happens. It's just a natural part of how people connect. But even when you are very, very young, it's just seen as a rite of passage in some way. So I kind of slipped into the culture very easily because I was 9 years old. So old enough to still remember what life was like in Zimbabwe, old enough to still remember the abuse that we all endured, but also young enough to quickly adapt to a completely new environment, you know. But I, from the very first time, Lewis, that alcohol passed my lips, I felt a sense of freedom that I don't know I'll ever feel ever again in that way, because it was my first time ever experiencing such freedom in my body. You know, I'd always been the immigrant for a long time, and it feels like a long time, from 9 years old, coming to a completely new country to 14 years old, you're made to feel like an immigrant that entire time. You're made to feel completely different. People are pointing out just how different you sound when words roll off your tongue. People are highlighting the color of your skin when you have never even thought about it. And I'm so grateful too, and this will tie into the oppression piece later, I'm so grateful that I'm from a family that never ever spoke about our skin color being some kind of burden, ever, ever. And this was even the early 2000s, when racism, especially in the country that I live in Britain, was so overt. It was not covert in any way. There was nothing like diversity. There was nothing like inclusion. My mom had been a geologist in Zimbabwe, but none of that meant anything anymore. She had to be a nurse. She had to be an adult nurse in nursing homes, care homes. So the racial abuse that she was experiencing on a daily basis, actual racist abuse, it never broke her. She was aware of it, but she didn't allow for that to change how she saw herself. So there was never any sense of we are less because of our skin color. It's that you can be aware of who you are, but never forget that you are from the Shona tribe. You are from Zimbabwe, you know. And I'm so grateful for that, because even though the insecurities, especially from school, did start to enter my auric field, I never, ever saw myself as less. Not even once. Not even once. At times I might have nearly believed it, but I never saw myself as less. But the first time that I drank alcohol, I realized just how much other people's projections and how much other people's, sometimes even just curiosities that just landed in a way that hurt me, you know, all of that disappeared. When I drank, all of that disappeared. I didn't have to think about any of it. So I kept on chasing the same feeling again and again and again and again for 10 years. And it got progressively worse because I would black out every single time that I drank. But also, from a shadow perspective, it's when the real Africa, the real me, could actually come out and play. Or so I thought, you know. I felt like I could only be wild if I was fucked up. I could only be sexual. I could only fuck and be fucked if I was completely out of my mind. So there was a freedom and a liberation that I felt then that I'm still grateful for, because it gave me access to so many parts of myself, parts that I still have today, which made me realize actually I was giving alcohol way too much credit. I'm like this anyway. I just needed to give myself permission. But that was that decade, me replicating my father's patterns.
I'm just moved by so many parts of that. I'm loving your mother's spirit and practice of, you know, you're from this tribe. What was the tribe?
Yes, Shona tribe. That's
Shona,
the,
you're from the Shona tribe.
Exactly, exactly.
Just to have that, this is the beauty of indigeneity, is you have this anchor to a place where even if you're not in that place anymore, there's this anchor to the place which reminds you of your belonging, regardless of where you are. And I think if there's this anchor to your own belonging inside yourself, you don't internalize other people's ideas or challenges of your belonging. And I really respect that. I relate to that. It wasn't my father, but my grandfather immigrated here from Puerto Rico.
Okay.
And he was a darker skinned Puerto Rican man, very thick accent, you know, could understand English, but couldn't speak it as largely as he would have liked to, and was obviously not the typical American model. Yet, I never experienced him internalizing anything about the racism. And like you said, actual racism,
yes.
Not just someone saying, where are you from, and calling that racist, but he actually experienced like harm done to his body and to things he was drinking and the way people challenged him and kept making money. And I mean, there were so many things he went through. He moved here right after segregation ended, and him and my grandmother, a German woman, fell in love. And it was interesting just to, when you were saying that, because I learned so much from him, seeing him navigate this world from his sense of belonging in himself and his faith in God and all these things that kind of held him together, that he was really unbreakable, and he was not political at all either.
Yes.
He would personally, and he did, he died very recently. He lived to an old age of 92, but he would kind of not even entertain a terminology that would identify him as anything. He just didn't play that game, and I saw his resilience from that. So I'm just connecting to him through your story of your mother.
Oh, I love that. I love that a lot.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. I'm also so much from that story as well. I love the presencing the gratitude for the medicine of alcohol, right?
Yes.
Because I teach addiction through this lens of, it's a desperation for safety that you don't know how to find in yourself. So it's not the substance, it's the desperation for safety you're chasing. And what I hear for you is, when you were drinking, there was this literal physiological safety that came over you. You said, I can do whatever I want and nothing bad's going to happen, like unencumbered. And it's, you required that alcohol for a decade to give that to you. And I guess my curiosity is, what was the shift that then said to you, oh, I can get this without the alcohol?
Oh, I love that. And the thing that you say around alcohol being medicine is language that I've never considered before. But I just noticed how relaxed my body felt the moment that you said it, because a big part of my work and a big part of what my own personal life work has been in the past 8 years of sobriety is really letting go of any of the just very rigid narratives, like absolutist narratives that I have around alcohol. Yes, I do choose a life where I completely abstain. So I haven't altered my mind state in any way up until recently, actually, when I had a psychedelic experience in 8 years. But even just to hear that that is an option for alcohol to be a medicine, that's really beautiful. That's really beautiful. So I just wanted to point that out too. And for me, the thing that shifted is I did start to realize just how, and I always want to make sure that when I'm reflecting on the past, that I'm not trying to put some kind of bow on it, you know, and create a story that wasn't entirely true. Because what was going to come out just then was that I felt quite disturbed because of, I would lose my memory for very long periods of time, because when you're in a blackout, you can't make any long-term memories. You can only make very, very short-term. So I can only remember a very recent conversation, maybe that happened 5 minutes ago, but maybe something that happened half an hour ago or more, I have no idea what happened. But in that time, no one else would be able to tell that I'm, you know, in this space of just being on autopilot. No one else would be able to tell, because I didn't stumble. I didn't, you know, have the typical behavior of someone that was drunk. I wasn't falling around everywhere. I would just have a very vacant look behind the eyes, but you would have to be very close to even see it. I would be talking the way that I'm talking now. I will make plans with you. I will say that I'll show up to this thing. I could host people, but I'm never going to remember any of it. So as time went on, I started to feel just a constant undercurrent of shame and anxiety of not knowing what had happened in that time frame. To start with, it was only a few hours, and then it was 5 hours, and then it would be 6 hours, and then it would be up to 8 or 9 hours where I have no idea what has happened. So what was going to come through my lips then is that I had to stop because of how disturbed I started to get. But that's not entirely true. I could have continued. Other people around me started to get very disturbed by what was happening, you know. And I didn't get well for myself. I chose to get well because my life was falling apart and it was starting to affect everyone else. I could have stayed in that destruction for a very long time, if I'm to be honest. I would have found a way to manage. I would have just, as I did very well, I would have just moved friendship groups, move another job, and then maybe keep that up for like a few months or whatever it is, then move again. I could have done that. But I started to lose everyone, because at some point the party stops. And most people, especially the culture of British people, most people will be way too uncomfortable to have a conversation with you to say, okay, we think something is wrong. You'll just see people drifting away. The invites become less and less and less. But also, I was from a family that was very conflict avoidant. So we never spoke about anything. Again, the exact same pattern with my father was being replicated with me. Even though the destruction was so obvious and it was permeating the walls of our home, right? You don't talk about it. We just don't talk about it. We just pretend that it's not happening, or they'll give me silent treatment, or, you know, we address it in passive aggressive means, but we don't directly address the thing. So that was the pattern that I was in for a very, very long time. And I could have stayed there, but my boyfriend at the time, and he's still in my life, so I always thank him for this. He's a friend of mine now. He gave me an ultimatum. I had relapsed so many times. That's also another point of this. It was never just a decision that I made and then I got better. From the age of 19 is when I realized that, okay, there's really a big, big problem here. Tried to get sober, relapsed, tried to get sober, maybe for a few months, maybe 4, relapsed again, maybe 2 months another time, relapsed again. And I quickly realized that there was more discomfort in being well than actually staying sober. So I didn't, you know, I didn't relapse because it was so uncomfortable to stay sober and I couldn't do it. I could do it pretty easily, actually, but it felt very uncomfortable to be reliable. It felt very uncomfortable to start having friends again. It felt very uncomfortable to show up to work on time. Things going well just did not feel good. That's the reason why I relapsed 7 times until my partner gave me an ultimatum. And then I thought it was just another thing that I'm saying I'm going to do again. But then I discovered the term self-sabotage. I was reading as I always did, researching as I always did after a blackout or something. And then I found the term self-sabotage. When what you say you want and your behavior are in direct conflict, when you pull the plug on yourself, when you're close to getting well. So there were so many things that I finally just had language for, so it stopped being a moral thing. I am bad. There is something wrong with me. And I was able to look at it just a little bit objectively. And then I continued reading, I continued sharing, and that allowed for me to stay sober. But honestly, I didn't think it was going to be, there was never any sort of big declaration of now it's time, this is going to be the final time. It was just another thing that I've promised I'm going to do. Let's see what happens, you know, just so I can keep my partner happy. It was more like that.
Well, so this is actually a wonderful somatic segue into this self-censorship work, because there's a visceral component, there's a physiological component to what we call self-sabotage. And essentially what that is, our subconscious is diverting us, you know, from experiencing something we don't have capacity for. So when you talk about wellness, being well, right, and having goodness and joy and things going your way, that takes a certain physiology of expansion. And that feeling of like loosening and being soft, understandably, with a childhood like yours where it wasn't predictable what was going to happen, your body probably learned through development to be tense, to be ready, to be on the guard.
Yes.
So our bodies do these things called overcouplings, where it's like a somatic association or guarantee, where it expects tightness to keep you safe and it expects looseness to be dangerous. And so most people that experience self-sabotage, the way you're explaining it, through something good, like things are going my way and I relapse, it's not because there's self-hatred involved, it's because there isn't capacity to hold this new way of living, right? And so I'm saying that piece because it goes right into self-censorship, doesn't it? And I educate so much on the fawning response, which is called the fourth F of trauma. Are you familiar with that, the fawning response?
I am. Right. You know what? When I found that language, I think I write just very briefly, maybe a paragraph in the third perspective. Finding that language sometime last year just blew my entire mind. And it was one of those moments, Lois, where I'm just like, thank fuck we have a word to describe this experience that most of us, right? And
it made me think,
why are we not hearing about fawning so much more?
So much more. Like in the education system, in the justice system, everywhere, fawning is so important to learn about, isn't it? And fawning is exactly this. There's such a visceral charge in the nervous system around your honesty being met with something unsavory, right? Like when you talk about the biology of belonging, that's the whole purpose of fawning. It's to appease the body in front of you so you don't rock the boat and get hurt. You know, it's meant as a survival strategy when you're threatened by another body. So no one would say to somebody who's being held at gunpoint, who smiles and laughs and says, take the money, no one would say, that's self-sabotage. They would say, good job. Mm-hmm. You know, you made that person think you liked them and they let you live. So it has its place. Yet when it becomes how we relate, then it's this indiscriminate way of just reflexively appeasing the bodies in front of us. And I say that because this is what fascinates me about your story. And again, where I see myself in parts of your story, you're in your early 20s and you're part of these social justice movements, which in my experience, as well as yours, as I've heard, over time become more intolerant with difference, even though there's such a focus on diversity and difference and inclusion. There's non-inclusion around something different, around something opposite, around disagreement. Like disagreement is overcoupled with harm in a lot of these circles. And so I was fascinated to hear you tell this story about how you had this big kind of wake-up moment when you publicly shamed somebody on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And I'm like dying to have you recount that here, if you wouldn't mind, because yes. It was a visceral moment. You felt it. And there was a somatic experience of feeling what you were doing. Yes. I need people to hear this. Can we dive into that together?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So for a little bit of context around this, once I got sober in 2016, I started doing a lot of sober advocacy work. As you can imagine, my sobriety led me on a not even just a spiritual path or a deeper understanding of addiction from a psychological lens, but it also made me very aware of the workings of the alcohol industry. it made me very aware of how alcohol is marketed to women, for example. It made me very, very aware of the fact that there are about 5 corner shops that are focused on alcohol in places that are of low income. It just made me start to view the world very differently. So naturally, I was led into the world of advocacy and activism in the space and niche of sobriety and recovery. But as is usually the case, and I was very happy for this, actually, you start to meet different people that are also activists, people that are body positive activists, you know, racial justice activists, abolitionists, whatever it might be. You meet so many people that are also very, very focused on their own mission, people that truly want to contribute and do something in the world, not to just sit around and complain, but people that are interested in solutions. So before, gosh, and trying to think back to this time as well, I have to look at that version of myself through a very compassionate lens. And I think this is an invitation that I would put forward for anyone listening to this, because I think it's so easy to divorce yourself from that past version of you.
Yep.
And to try and put forward the you that you are now with nothing to do with this person before. But I love that version of Africa. She had just discovered that she can actually add something, you know, that through her getting well, she can help other people get well. It's where I discovered that I'm very natural at speaking, that I love speaking. It's where I discovered that, you know, that I'm able to take very complex concepts and to just deliver them in a way that people can understand. So that version of me was so fearless in a lot of ways. But she also had it so wrong in a lot of ways, you know. But the world of activism was a very interesting one, because even though I didn't call myself an activist, it's where I first experienced that label being placed onto me. And honestly, I never for a second said that I was an activist. I never said that any of the work that I was doing, I'm looking at it through the lens of being a Black woman. But as you can probably imagine, every interview conversation that I had around sobriety, the interviewer would open with, "So Africa, as a Black woman, what are you?" So already, the question is being positioned so that I can find fault, not even just in the world of recovery or whatever it is, but now I have to also do it through a racialized lens.
That's right.
That's why I really started to notice this sort of and at the time I felt, again, the self-censorship. I felt that I couldn't question it, that I just had to accept it, that I should be grateful because I'm even being interviewed to begin with, and I'm being given this opportunity to begin with, you know. So the fawning was the default for me, especially at that time. But then it was also very interesting, because in the spaces that are being lauded as safe in my own community groups, in all of the different groups that I was now a part of, in regards to race or disabilities or whatever it might be, there's this idea that no one is free until we are all free. So you shouldn't just be focusing on recovery. You should be focusing on recovery for people who are Black, but recovery for people who are Black and disabled, recovery for people who are Black, disabled, and trans. And you need to be including everyone. And I did my fucking best, Lewis, but as you can imagine, there's only...
I'm seeing this like sweet, tired, well-meaning young woman trying her because I was that young man. I was that young man. So I can feel him. It's very sweet of them to try.
Oh my God. But in the beginning, I just want to do my best. I want to try. I want to make everyone feel included. It was around the time that I was being told that the word women, you should put an X on the E so that all women feel included. I was like, yeah, of course, I'll do that. But then other people will tell you that it's wrong. And it's not just happening externally. It's within the communities that I'm a part of. So again, it's where I started to notice just how important identity was. And at this time, it was fine. I was okay with it because I'm learning. I'm wanting to understand. And I want to belong. I'm finally part of a community where people will stay. People are not leaving. People are not walking away from me. I'm not waking up in the morning wondering what I did. I'm part of a community and I'm valued by this community. So I will do what I need to do to stay and to be part of it and to be in their good graces, you know?
Let's underline that for a moment. That's very
Absolutely.
Important.
Mm-hmm.
All of this comes down to the desperation to belong.
God.
You know, I belong somewhere. And again, your biology of belonging, you open the book with, and the work that I teach with fawning, there is an ancestry in these bodies to know that our work is to belong so we can survive.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just very important for people to hear this reflexive agreeing and going along with, reflexive being the key word there. It is in service of belonging. It's all it comes down to. We want to belong. Hey, my friends. I created a space that is affordable, accessible, and anyone is allowed to join anytime, and it's called the Library Membership. The Library Membership is an online private platform that hosts dozens of my webinars, my somatic practices, private mini lectures, and movement practices. There's also a monthly sound healing, and you'll be invited to a weekly Tuesday live mini practice with me and other participants. You'll also be invited to be a live audience member in our monthly HLN team podcast recordings, where you'll take place in the Q&A that happens off air after the episode is filmed. For more information on this membership, click on the link below or go to holisticlifenavigation.com and click on membership and then library. You can join right now and you can cancel or pause your subscription at any time. I look forward to seeing you in there.
Gosh, and belonging is such a beautiful thing. It's never something that I want to get rid of because I know the loneliness that can come with hyper-individualism. And I think we are in a time of hyper-individualism under the guise of connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to see it in these communities, actually, that we're saying we want connection. We're saying that we want to build a collective, a global collective, but we're so individualistic in our view of the world, because if you are not using the right language as me, then you are wrong.
That's
if
right.
you're not up to date with the latest terminology and you address me in the way that I need you to address me right now, which can change in just a moment,
mm-hmm.
then you are XYZ. So I it's so interesting how there's so much the packaging is supposed to be, you know, a collective packaging, but it's so individualistic in nature. And I really started to see it in all of its glory at that time. But when I started to notice that discomfort, that even though I was having all of these questions and thoughts and didn't feel good about being told that I needed to lead with my identity, and no one was saying, Africa, you need to lead with your identity, but everything by design meant that I needed to acknowledge my identity always, my race, my sex, any sort of privilege that I had. I'm supposed to have all of these identity markers right there next to me. And I'm supposed to scan for yours before I decide whether I will listen to what you're saying or not. I have to know your ethnicity. I have to know who you are. I have to know it's quite mad when you really think about it.
Well,
but
as I
the,
hear you saying it, my stomach's tightening. Like,
yeah,
I'm like thinking of
absolutely.
How exhausting and stressful it is to know when I'm permitted to express and be myself, you know, based on the markers you have or don't have.
It's that level of surveillance. I could see just how sick it was making me, but it was also making, but all of us were sick.
Mm-hmm.
But then you
That's
get,
right.
You know, but you're awarded for being unwell.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
Because the amount of people that would feel guilty for experiencing joy, that we feel guilty for things actually going well in their life, feel guilty for coming from a two-parent household, because then you're told you're a privileged person or whatever
guilty
it might
for
be.
Privilege, right?
Absolutely. So the again, by design, whether we realize this or not, we had created something that kept us perpetually unwell, but also we've created an environment internally and externally where you're only socially rewarded if you are unwell. if you are in a rageful state, if you are constantly angry, if you look at life through the lens of where is the malice? Is this a malicious interaction? And if I don't think it is, how could it be a malicious interaction?
I mean, I should say this is that moment where that post we started talking about, where you were scared to say, I'm not oppressed, you know, to say I'm not suffering.
Yeah.
You were breaking up with this ideology and identity that had rewarded you such belonging, because people agree with you like that. Yeah, you're oppressed, Africa. But to say I'm not, that's where the ruptures come in relationally.
Massively. And I would say everything peaked for me in 2020, which leads back to the post that you were talking about, the man that I shamed online. Of course, I'm sure that many of us listening will be very, very aware of what happened in early summer 2020 with the death of George Floyd and the conversations that sparked all around the world, you know, not even just North America or Europe or global conversations. And I truly believe to this day that so many of them were very, very, very important, because the carpet was lifted and the things that we saw, we couldn't unsee them. And there's so many things that I've said I'm grateful for in this conversation. And that year is one of those years. I think there were a lot of useful conversations that happened. And I would say it took a turn very, very quickly, where there was a level of, Lewis, how would you even describe? Because I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about, and the energy of that year. How would you even describe it? Was it disconnection doesn't quite cut it. Polarization doesn't.
You're on something with the disconnection, because I would call it dissociation. Because what I thought was so amazing was it happened to be at the same time we were stuck at home and virtual. And so it was the majority of us culturally, if I can speak only as an American, were stuck in our homes, on Zoom, on our phones, unable to go out, unable to have our businesses, anything that was tangible or tactile that we could feel. So we were in these states of being virtual icons to each other, which means you're not in your body. So all you are is ideology. And then on top of it, you have all this extremely violent, painful imagery you're being shown, true imagery, nothing made up, that's also deeply affecting your body. But because there's no tactile environmental relating, because it's dissociated online, we all became desperate to somehow avoid the heartbreak and hopelessness. And I think that desperation is where we project these ideas that if you're doing this, you're harmful. Kind of like made up these rules to alleviate our own suffering, if you will, or disconnection or isolation.
Absolutely. And thank you. Thank you for articulating that, because that's exactly what it felt like. And I know that it did for a lot of people. So for me, I behaved in a way that surprised me. I had always sort of been a witness to call out culture, if you will. And I use that term specifically because I do think there are differences, although I'd be curious to know how you define cancel culture and how I define it. Because I think sometimes most of the time we have a definition issue. I think we end up just sort of never getting anywhere because we're not even working with the same definition, you know, right? But I think call out culture is a very specific thing, right? Where there's this idea that your community will call you in if they think that you're taking the wrong approach, or you're going about things in a way that is not really supportive of your desired outcome or the desired outcome of the collective or whatever it might be. Someone just inviting you in to see whether they can offer an alternative, a different way of doing things, or tough love, whatever you want to call it, but it's usually from a loving place. That's the whole idea. The execution, however, looks nothing like I just fucking described. It looks nothing.
As you're saying it, I'm like, damn, I like her dream of this.
Me too.
This is a nice dream. I'll take that one.
The execution of this means that you will be pulled by your tie and your whatever clothing you have through the comments section, into the DMs,
That's right.
onto every other platform that exists. That's the
Reposted.
actual, that's the,
Ask everyone
that's
to
the
jump in
actual,
on you. That's right.
absolutely. You will have a screen grab and then an annotation of where you have, why you're a bigot or whatever might,
That's
that's
right.
the actual execution of it, right? And I'd always been a spectator of this culture and felt deeply uncomfortable by some of the things that I saw, even though some of the people, that were leading the charge were my friends, because I was quite immersed in activist spaces at the time. There were people that I knew. So I was always able to justify their actions because of my personal relationship with them, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
But also because I truly believed that we are all just trying to do our best. We're all trying to call out harm so we can create a world that is actually just in some kind of way, which is a very, even as I say that, how self-important is that?
It's amazingly self. Even when you say
Oh my
that's what gets
goodness.
me, because the idea of calling it out or even calling it in to prevent or get rid of harm, like, well, how do I know your way of doing it is the way we're going to get rid of harm? Who gives the authority,
Absolutely.
right, of whose way is the right way? And what interests me with that, with even the term call out or cancel, is the lack of curiosity, because
Yes. Yes.
I've been blessed for whatever reason to only have been attempted cancel like 3 times. And the way I present in the world and the things I talk about, I should be canceled more than I've been, but it's been tempted. But there's never been, in all these attempts, there's no questions. There's no, what did you mean when you said that, Louise? There's no,
None.
where does that come from for
None.
you? There's no, well, oh, am I getting this right? There's just an instantaneous, this is harmful, back up. Or you are this, 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 this. There's no
That's
relationship to
it.
even
It's
what they're
very
calling.
absolutist.
Exactly.
No, not at
Exactly.
all. Because the goal is not connection. It just
That's
isn't.
right. That's
The
right.
goal is superiority.
That's
The
right.
goal is absolutely superiority. And that's exactly what I experienced, it being my own goal at the time. So I'd always been a spectator. But then in 2020, there was also a lot of pressure for people to share very specific things. If you don't speak up, then you are XYZ. If you don't say this, if you don't post this. So that's the charge that I joined. I had never, ever done that before, especially not in that way, which is why I say I saw a side of myself that I'm still so curious about to this day. And I love sort of going there mentally and trying to unpick it and explore it. But it was a feeling of power. There was a sense of power that I felt in my own righteousness. And it felt so delicious and again, arousing, right? Especially because of that immediate response. Just like you said, everyone globally was at home. We built in that time a relationship with technology that changed everything. There was a time where we even lied to ourselves and thought that technology was separate to who we are, but that time informed everything. So throwing out an opinion into the world, especially if it's one that's outraged in some way, offended in some way, whatever it is, you got an immediate response from hundreds, thousands of people. Things spread like wildfire, quite literally. And I already had my platform then and I had a profile then. So, of course, it spread even faster. So, there was a man who sent me a DM and he was a mixed race man, darker skinned mixed race man. And he was just curious about my approach. He was actually very loving. He was not antagonistic in any way, which again made me feel even more. It poked me right where it needed to because of his love and his compassion, which is just, but that is how it works. That is how it works. And he was just curious about my approach. He probably led saying something like, "Sister, I just had a question. Do you think this is the right way?" I might be paraphrasing, but it was around, "Do you think that this is the right way to get people to understand what is going on?" Something along those lines. And I didn't even respond to him immediately. I took a screenshot of it. I posted it, not even onto my Instagram story, where there's some sense of privacy. You know, it doesn't have the same sort of spectatorship that it
That's
does
what it
when
is.
you put it onto, that's exactly what it is. You know, my intention, and it all happened so quickly, but I could watch myself doing it so quickly. My intention was to humiliate him. My intention was to punish him in front of the entire village, you know.
There it is. Yeah.
Gosh. So I shared it. And as you can imagine, immediately people are ripping this man apart in the comments. No, just like you said, no one asked a question. And those that asked questions were berated by the mob for even daring to ask questions, you know. And it's this thing spread so quickly. And I saw and can feel what was happening again, that excitement within me, but like a nervousness and almost like a sickness as well, because I was doing something that I've never done before in this way. Like, this is a part of Africa that my audience had never seen. So the shadow, right?
That's the shadow. This is what you said in the beginning about famous people have worked with the shadow in a way other people can't. This is
absolutely. My audience is seeing a side of me that they've never seen before, and I'm being rewarded for it so quickly. Thousands of people, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. And maybe about 45 minutes, the only thing that remained was the sickness. The arousal was gone. The excitement was gone. The kind of elation, if you will, was gone. And the only thing that remained was like an actual physical sickness. So I get migraines. I've been getting chronic migraines since I was about 11. They're not as severe anymore. And I remember having one of the worst migraines I have ever had. And I knew exactly what had induced it. I knew exactly what had induced it. I had, for the first time in sobriety, crossed my own boundaries and my integrity line in a way that I just... And I deleted that post.
Wait, I have to stop there because that's really important.
Please, please,
so important,
please do.
What you're saying. So this is important to me because the innate physiology with fawning is to violate one's boundaries. Is the purpose of fawning. It's like if someone, you know, we have this term for sexual fawning. If someone's assaulting you or pressuring you, and you have a choice, I could fight back and get killed, or I could acquiesce and survive. The purpose of it is to acquiesce and survive. So you're supposed to break a boundary, yet show that you feel differently. This is the self-sabotage piece too. So you can survive. So this is so important to me because the way I help people stop fawning is this, to somatically experience what it feels like to have the boundary violation. Because if you can't feel that, what you're attuning to is the first part, which is the high of the reward of belonging. Then usually after that, what follows is dissociation. So you live between numbness and high. And when this other piece emerges, this sickness, this nausea, which nausea is the number one signal of boundary violation. It's the beginning of fight response. When you feel that, that's your body saying to you, something was crossed in me. I abandoned a part of myself. And so the fact that you had this kind of spontaneous somatic experience is quite a gift to your whole outcome, to where you are now. Can you see that now? Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And oh my gosh, this is why your work is so needed and so important. And I'm so grateful that we could sit together again. We're going to have to do this as many times as possible because we've tapped into something here.
No question. I'm aware
but
of that.
But I can absolutely see it. Because in that decade of addiction and all of the things that came with it, you better believe that sexual fawning was part and parcel of it. The very first time that I drank when I was 14 is also the first time that I had sex. So from that moment, another thing I always say is that my brain associated alcohol with sex. So any time that I was drinking, whether fucked up or I've only just had a little bit, It's almost as if my body was available for whoever wanted it. Even if
Yes.
I didn't want to, I would always feel like I had to. If
That's
this
right.
person wants to, then I have to. Or that thing, which I know most girls and women and even men will have experienced, where in a single moment you're invited to make a choice. Do I say no to this person or reject them in some way and risk my safety? Or do I just, what's 5 minutes? What's 10 minutes? No.
That's
So,
right.
yeah, so
That's right.
that,
And that's the same physiology, even
gosh.
though it's sexual in that case. That's the same thing that's happening internally when you're sitting there having the
Absolutely.
interview and they're like, as a black woman, how does it feel to you? And you're like, I'm just going to do this
Absolutely.
for 20 minutes. I can get through. It's the same difference, isn't it?
Man, absolutely. So in that decade, I was able to numb that recognition with alcohol. But
Yes.
then in
Yes.
2020, sitting, I couldn't, I
Couldn't numb it anymore.
felt
Ooh, that's good.
everything,
Yeah.
everything.
How did that feeling? Just checking in with you. Do you have 15 more minutes or do you have a hard
Oh,
stop?
absolutely. No, no,
Okay,
no,
great.
no.
How did that moment of nausea, of feeling like, fuck, I can't pretend this felt good. What did that propel you to do next to get you where you are now? Around this really open, truly practice of an open mind and questioning and losing friends and losing identities and losing groups to belong to. Like, how did that propel you?
Oh, such a great question. And you know what? I had been practicing for a while, because by that point in 2020, I had already been studying, researching, doing so much work to understand self-sabotage. And I'd already been doing so much work to understand self-censorship, but it was always in a slightly different context, you know. So I was already working with the types of people that I work with now. I was already coaching, I was already studying. I was a student. At that point in time, I had already been a student. So I had a good place to work from. So that sickness and recognition was amplified by the fact that I should know better. Wow, this is happening to me, but I've read all of these
Love that.
books.
Love that. So good. Yeah. So
Oh
good.
my, so it was like I was naked in the middle of Oxford Circus. Oxford Circus is our version of Times Square,
Okay,
basically,
got it.
right? So it's almost as if I was standing there stark ass naked and just looking at my own body for the first time and realizing, oh, I'm naked in front of all of these people, you know? And it was very humbling. It was very, very, very humbling. And that is the day that I coined the term collective sabotage, the term that we call cancel culture,
So good, yeah.
because I realized that I had just participated in something that I'm so fundamentally against. And I'm so thankful that I got to feel that and experience that, because that became the unraveling for everything. Suddenly, in that moment, and I remember sitting there, I deleted that post and I sent a message to this guy, and then I unsent the message, and then I just deleted Instagram off my app, and then I sat for maybe 4 or 5 hours and I was just writing different things. But my mind started collecting all of those different moments when I couldn't ask questions within activist groups, where I felt petrified to point out a contradiction, where I really wanted to understand, what do we mean when we say that all white people are inherently racist? That was always one of the things I truly wanted to understand. As someone that was born and raised in Zimbabwe and grew up around all different types of white people, I wanted to understand, when we talk about a white person in Norway and Kenya and South Africa, they're very di like I
Yep.
a lot of things didn't make sense. But again, it's the mantras and it's the scripts, and you just repeat it, you don't question it, you just chant and chant and chant, and that's it. But suddenly I was hearing those scripts in a very different way. So I just started writing things down, started going back to all of those different experiences where I was told that I can't say the word woman, because if I say the word woman, it's leaving out all of these people. But then I needed to understand. So Does that apply for a young girl who is in Somalia and she's going to have her clitoris mutilated? How does identity come into? There were so many things
Absolutely.
I really wanted to understand, but I was terrified of asking. So I started
So I was
writing
internally
quickly.
living with you all this time, and
Yes,
you just were blocking.
absolutely.
Oh, interesting.
Absolutely. I'd been blocking all of the questions. That's why in the book that I wrote, The Third Perspective, I think it's chapter two, which I call Befriending the Mob in Your Mind, because that's exactly what I needed to.
I
That
love that so
mob,
much. Yeah.
gosh, that mob had been taking on the job of self-editing, self-surveilling, monitoring my speech in every single moment. Before someone even had to do it
Yeah.
externally, I had started to do it to myself. So that incident with that man on Instagram and me feeling that sickness, being with that sickness, not trying to will it away, take a painkiller to make it go away or whatever it is, and actually just be with it, I was able to actually see the mob for who they are. It's almost like they were handing me back all of these files that they had taken from me. That's the visual that I have sometimes. Gosh, and I just started writing and writing and writing, and I went into the archive of people that I discarded. And what I mean by that specifically is that something that would happen all the time for the about 4.5 years that I was heavily in activist spaces, people will tell you who you shouldn't listen to.
Yes.
And if someone says,
Yes.
do not listen to this person, or this person is problematic, this person is a bigot, you don't ask any questions, you just don't listen. You
Then by
discard.
association, I'm a bigot.
Oh,
I'm problematical.
absolutely.
Yeah.
But not even that. I think that became a worry later on, but it's trust. I trust my sister. I trust my brother. They're just looking out for me. It's very
Oh, wow.
religious in
That's
its
even deeper.
workings, right?
Yeah, that's even
Yeah,
deeper
so
than just the idea of
much.
I don't even question where it comes from, just what they say must be true
Yes.
if I trust them.
What they say must be true. And let's go a layer deeper as well, especially if they have a superior identity to me, then I
Yeah.
absolutely have to take it.
Yeah.
So every decision, and I didn't even realize this, because to me, I'm a curious person, I'm a confident person, I've been speaking in the way that I do for a while, but I hadn't realized that there are some areas that I've been told are no-go areas. Africa, you get to be curious there, but not here. You get to ask questions there, but not here,
Can I ask you something about
So there
that?
were so many, please, please.
I want to share a piece with. So the last 3 years, I have this
Yes.
weekly practice of I watch far right commentary, and I watch far left
Yes.
commentary, and I watch center left, all these words we have. I don't identify with any of them
Amazing.
personally, but I watch it all, and my practice is, okay, who do I agree with? It's not like who I disagree with,
Yes.
who would I disagree with, who do I agree with? And it's so fun and incredible because I have managed to deeply humanize all these parts that, people would say exactly to me, Luis, if you listen to this person, that's a really big problem. That's offensive, that's harmful. You're normalizing their harm and their violence. And now I say to that, oh my gosh, I love them. Which is even scarier for someone who doesn't want me to listen to them. But I love them. I understand them. I see where they're coming from, whether I agree with them or not. And I've got to have the pleasure over the years of watching you go on certain interviews with people and speak about certain people.
Absolutely.
And you're just so fluid with these people and yourself. But I hear this kind of relational experience emerging in all these
Yes.
different interviews and people you sit with. And I guess I just want to ask you, how do you feel? I feel more free. And I'm assuming you're experiencing that too, this freedom of I don't have to stop anywhere. I can just endlessly be curious if I wish to be. Like, how free is
Oh,
that?
absolutely. Even as you say it, I can just feel it in my chest, like a ah. It's so beautiful, especially because there was a time when I would never have dared listen to something.
Yeah.
Listen to something in the privacy of my own home,
Yes,
even
yes.
under the covers, just listening to whatever it
That's
is,
right.
terrified, let alone publicly do so. It is so
Yeah.
freeing. It is, my goodness. And I that thing around humanizing people is where it begins for me.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to give someone the benefit of the doubt. I do have my boundaries. I have my own convictions. I have other areas where maybe I'm not quite ready to be convinced around this just yet. And that's fine. I'll get there. But I really just want to meet someone without looking at them through the lens of you're right, I'm left, you're pro, you're anti, you're the, it, that's
You got it.
no, because when I do that, I dehumanize myself too.
Yeah,
that's
you
another
do.
way that I like to think about things. When I dehumanize someone else, I do the same to myself too. But I really enjoy it because I love being surprised, very similar to you. And it's a practice that I recommend to clients all the time, to just listen to something that can shift your perspective, not because you need to change it. Don't even make that the goal, but see if you can pick up something new and interesting. Maybe the least that you will get is actually this person is well dressed. I don't care for what they have to say, but actually they know how to pull together a fucking look. Okay.
That's
However,
right. That's right. That's right. That's
find
right.
something. There's always something if you're willing to look. And for me, I realized that it sounds so simple, but I want to know what thoughts are really mine. You know, if I don't like
Yes.
something, I want to know.
Yes.
Wouldn't you want to just know?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, there's two things I'd like to share with you that are coming up for me.
Please.
When you're talking about that public shaming, it took me right back to fifth grade. And part of my, I use the word privilege as the way I see it, which means just something I have, you don't, something I've experienced, you don't.
Yes.
And one of my privileges is to have been born with what's called an intersex expression. And so when I was developing, my body made all this estrogen. And I developed breasts and hips, and parts of me looked very female and parts of me felt very female, even though in many ways I'm male. And so this physiology and biology of opposition merging in one body, also in a family with mixed race, also being a bisexual person, it's like I feel like I was born into the bridge of, well, everything's kind of true. You know, everything's true. And so I'm saying that because initially it was the source of the greatest hell of my life, because I was hated, you know, by my male peers growing up, having this ambiguous body and this mindset and a more feminine way of being. And in the fifth grade, I had my chance to belong. All the bullies that used to pick on me on the bus turned to this girl and started chanting this horrible phrase to her about her nose, because she had this really big pointy nose. And I felt, this is my moment to join the mob and disappear. Like, I get to disappear into the mob and not be their target. And I jumped in, I chanted. And I remember exactly what you're saying. I remember the high of belonging and the high of, okay, the people here agree with me because more people are agreeing than not. And the safety of not being the target, but being the bully. And then I got off the bus and stricken with nausea and guilt and pain and heartbreak that I deeply hurt somebody, you know, to that extent for belonging. And I didn't know this intellectually as a fifth grader. I just felt it all. And it was many years later, I was able to integrate it, and it completely changed my life. And then when I was 19, I was working at a gas station. And I was campaigning for Hillary Clinton, and I identified as a liberal and a Democrat. And I hated Republicans, all these things, dehumanized them like crazy. And I was without a home, and I was in need of a home ASAP, or I had to move back to where I came from, and I didn't want to do that. And this woman who drove taxi cabs for a living came in. She was a Republican, and she took me in. And she took me in and let me live in her attic. And I lived with her for a year and a half. We became best friends. And my entire life changed. I get chills when I think about it. So I'm sharing this because these are some of the places I come from that when I see you, I see family, because of this, you know, this beautiful journey of being wrong, like the gift of being wrong. And so I felt like I wanted to offer that and see how that lands in you, and, you know, where you go with those pieces.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to treasure that share forever. I really will. Thank you. I can feel my body tingling right now, because every time someone, anyone just shares with me something that is so honest, something where they have really allowed themselves to be surprised by people, you know. It's not something that I take for granted at all. Wow. It shows you how useless a lot of these terms are, right? What the fuck does
Useless.
Republican mean? What does Democrat...
Useless.
Who even... It means
absolutely
nothing.
Useless.
It means something, and it means absolutely nothing in the grand scheme of things. I think that's something that really, again, humbled me. All of those years ago, and I remember sending a message to that man and really apologizing the following day, really apologizing for what I did. And he responded, and he was like, that's absolutely fine. He didn't say much. He just said, that's absolutely fine. And I don't know what that's absolutely fine meant for him, you know. But I just... Even the fact that he humanized me in that moment, he didn't
Yes,
have to. He didn't
I
have to
love that.
respond. He didn't have to say anything. He, you know, instinctively could have blocked me, which is our instinctive thing to kind of shut out noise, right? It could be. But even to humanize me and to reply, that's absolutely fine.
Now, I
You
want to
know?
say that your book, because we have to start closing, your book, The Third Perspective, is really teaches us all how to do this. It teaches us all how to sit with this physically, how to sit with it cognitively, how to get to this place through beautiful philosophies and prompts and true stories of your own, of how to essentially build the capacity to express your truth. And what I love about it is you don't speak to it in an immature way. And what I mean by that is there's the, I've repressed myself my whole life, which means I never developed expressing. So when I start expressing, it's so crude and ignorant and malicious. And that's not what you do. It's so special. So I kind of want to start closing on that piece of anything you want the listener to know. The book you can get in the episode detail, the link will be there.
Thank
anything you.
You
want the listener to know around your distinct, clear, I don't know if method is the right word, or language, just around the difference between, or how you can help them express what's true for them, as you have been able to do, without hurting people, you know, having like embodied mature expression of truth.
I love that. And I would say the work that I do and everything that you will find in most of my writings, not even just this book, The Third Perspective, it's about mind, tongue, and soul liberation. That's how I think of the work that I do.
That's good.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is. And that is going to look so different for us. The subtitle of the book is Brave Expression in the Age of Intolerance. And that was a very intentional title, because in the climate that we're in, there are people that are going to pick it up and will think, oh, thank goodness someone's talking about all of those intolerant people. That's going to be most people. And then immediately, I'm inviting you to look at your own intolerance.
That's
Where are
right.
you intolerant of yourself, right? Because that's what we're projecting out into the world. So my research from self-sabotage to collective sabotage is not accidental. We all want to fix the collective. What do we do about cancel culture? Other people are intolerant, but we're not even cognizant of our own intolerance. So I shaped this book through three pillars of awareness, responsibility, and expression, because a lot of people want to jump to expression. What do I say and how do I say it confidently? How can I share my opinions online without being afraid? We want to externalize. How do I express? But if you're not aware of what you're afraid of, if you have no idea what that mob in your mind is saying or what files they're withholding from you, how can you express yourself? If you're not willing to take responsibility for your wrong thoughts, how can you express what is actually true? You know, so I take you through a very fun journey, because I don't think it all needs to be dark and heavy. I think there's something beautiful about laughing at how absurd all of this is. Even what we're doing
Absolutely.
right now, look at what we have
Absolutely.
in our ears, this tech. What is it? We're just animals in shirts? What are we doing?
Animals in shirts. That's absolutely correct. I couldn't agree
You
with you
know?
more. Take the preciousness out of it, right?
It all means something, but it means nothing. And I think that can be so freeing, especially when it comes to expression. You get to play however you want to play. Even when I work with clients, something I think about when I speak about self-censorship, when you make love, how are you censoring your body? You know a way in which you want to move, a way in which you want to vocalize, a way in which you want to laugh and be playful, but you're holding that back because it might be silly. Because I've been with this person for 5 years. If I randomly do this or ask for this, what will they? Look at the everyday moments where you are self-centering. It's not just about what you say, it's in your body language. So we talk a lot about that in the book. It's in your body language. It's how you walk into a room. It's how you carry yourself. We are self-centering in so many ways, but I think that's where it can get exciting because you're shown that brave expression is not just words. It's actually who you're being in those little micro moments. I'm really looking forward to you reading this book. And if anything resonates through this conversation, they can always get in touch with me and I can direct them to either episodes that I've done or any other resources that could be supportive to the book as well.
Well, I'm just thrilled that I got to sit with you. I think this is the invocation of more sitting and more
Yes.
playing. There's so much here I want to play with that we don't have
I
time with.
know.
But oh my goodness, thank you for your contribution to this earth and to me. I'm so grateful.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I feel so good in my body right now. I'm about to go for a walk. I'm about to finish my tea and then I'm about to walk. I'm going to send you some of this tea, actually. So send me your address after this. But I'm so grateful. So grateful. I feel that I have much to learn from you too. Possibly I need to have you onto my podcast too so we can continue this conversation. I just love the marrying of the somatic because I think that's a piece that is not spoken about enough. And I think it's a piece that if people truly understood its significance, it would make communication, expression, intimacy so much more tangible for people because I think a lot of this feels so abstract. You know,
That's
it all
right.
just feels like ideas and information, but it's so much more than that. And I think your work speaks to that. So I'm very, very grateful for you and all that you're doing, really.
Thank you, love. Really appreciate that. You have a beautiful, beautiful walk and tea, and I cannot wait to get the tea. I'll steep the
Yes.
tea and we'll have virtual tea. How about
Yes,
that?
please.
Take care.
Thank you.
That's the end of today's episode. Now let's take a moment to notice where we feel the episode in our bodies. Close your eyes. Take a breath. And let whatever wants to come up, come up. And remember, those sensations hold the wisdom that we're looking for. If you want to go deeper, visit holisticlifenavigation.com. Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called actually, but the place that we're gonna be in is called Menla. And it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person.